Good evening, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. This evening's show is brought to you by Eden Foods, the most trusted name in certified organic clean food. Shop online at EdenFoods.com and enter the coupon code ORGVIEW, that's ORGVIEW, when prompted during checkout to receive 20% off any regularly priced items, excluding cases. For other promotional offers, please visit TheOrganicView.com's website. Good evening, everyone. After 39 years as a commercial beekeeper, Tom Theobald is hanging on by a thin, fragile thread. The impact of neonicotinoid exposure has made it impossible for him to continue operating his beekeeping company. Now, although he's been struggling to protect his bees, this very well may be the last year that he's in business. So tonight, we're going to take calls from the audience. So if you have any questions for Tom, we're going to be taking calls a little bit into the show. Please call 917-932-1068 and press 1 to connect to the switchboard. Or you can email the show your questions at questions@TheOrganicView.com. So I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good evening, Tom.
Hello, June. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Like we don't talk all the time.
Right.
Well, actually, tonight, this is not a laughing matter. I mean, this is, I'm really grateful that you decided to talk about your own personal experiences because, you know, for the folks that have been listening to us talk over the last several years, they know how much we have been advocating against the use of neonicotinoids, but now it's getting very, very personal with you. Now, before we get into what's going on currently, there are a lot of people that really don't have any clue what's going on with the bees, much less what neonicotinoids are. So before we begin, can you share with our listeners a little bit about how you got started and why you became a beekeeper?
Sure. I became a beekeeper for some of the same reasons that a lot of people are becoming beekeepers today. I had concluded a 10-year experience in the corporate world, and I had a little time, and we'd always had a large garden, and I knew a little bit about bees, and I thought that it would be interesting to take some time and have a colony or two of bees to complement the garden. And I talked with a 90-year-old beekeeper and came away with the strong impression that the man and his wife had done something that they'd really been touched by, and started working with a smaller operator and worked through the harvest and found that at one time people had actually made a living at beekeeping on a community scale and decided that I was going to try to do that. And that was 39 years ago, and a lot of hard work, a certain amount of risk, a lot of ups and downs, but I was able to pull it off, and I did have a healthy beekeeping operation for most of those 39 years.
Now, Tom, when did you notice the first signs of, quote, colony collapse? Now, please note, I did not say disorder. And if you don't mind, could you explain to the listeners why I omitted the word disorder?
Sure. It goes back in Boulder County, which is where I keep bees. It goes back to about 1995, and it begins with the varroa mite, a parasitic mite that never had been seen in North America until about 1987 or 88. It worked its way across the country, and I first identified it here in Boulder County in 1995, and that was when we began to see a steep increase in the losses. And in an operation like mine, where I can give the colonies pretty close attention, historically I would have had losses on the order of 2 to 5% in the winter. that escalated to 10 to 15, then to 20%, and in my business, that was pretty substantial. But after a few years, we began to come to terms with the mites. We began to understand how to manage to hold them in check. And in spite of that, the losses continued. And in fact, they escalated. And we didn't really understand why until we had the opportunity to look back. And I think it's fairly clear at this point that what we were seeing was the entry into the world of beekeeping of the systemic pesticides, primarily a family called neonicotinoids, chlorinated nicotine compounds. And the first of those, imidacloprid, was introduced in the United States in 1994. And I think what was happening is, as we began to understand the management of the mites, the effects of the systemic pesticide were beginning to take hold. We just didn't recognize what it was in the beginning. We certainly do now.
Now, Tom, can you share with the listeners about the infamous leaked memo? Because I remember before I met you, there was that had been circulating in the beekeeping community. And then, if I'm not mistaken, I had reached out to Phil Chandler, who's the host of, I think, the Barefoot Beekeeper, I think it is, his show, wonderful show. He's a fantastic beekeeper. And that's when I first learned about the leaked memo.
Well, there are a whole series of neonicotinoids. Imidacloprid was the first. And in 2003, the second appeared on the market, and it was rushed to the market and given a conditional registration. And that whole thing itself is interesting because if we look at the evidence, it was not a unique answer to some insect scourge. The reason it was rushed to the market was because Bayer was about to lose its patent on imidacloprid. So it was rushed to the market, and we've suffered these losses over all these years to protect Bayer's market share. In any event, it was given a conditional registration in 2003, came on the market, and the condition of that registration is what is called the Cutler-Dupree study. And this was done in Canada, and it was intended to assess the potential damages from these neonicotinoids to honeybees, because there was ample evidence from France that these were highly toxic to bees. And in fact, the EPA scientists had said exactly that, and they had made the warning that this was highly toxic. And the condition of conditional registration was the Cutler-Dupree study. It was to have been completed within 2 years. It languished for 4 or 5, finally was completed in 2006, I believe, 7, and the EPA sat on it for 15 months, finally reviewed it and concluded that it was scientifically sound. Well, for the next several months, they denied that they even had it, but they finally had to divulge it, and the public had an opportunity to take a look at whether it was scientifically sound or not. And the consensus of opinion was that it was nonsense. I mentioned it to my 12-year-old granddaughter at the time, and she said, "Grandpa, that's bogus." You know, she could recognize it. So anyway, the Cutler-Dupree study was the basis for releasing this chemical to the market, the reason that it was being used on hundreds of millions of acres. I wrote an article in 2010 for a beekeeping publication called Bee Culture, in which I called into question the quality of the Cutler-Dupree study. And in the fall of that year, Bayer petitioned the EPA for an extension of the use of clothianidin to cotton and mustard. And the EPA scientist, in part because of the article that I had written, went back and reviewed the Cutler-Dupree study and concluded that it was invalid. Invalid proved to be a little too strong a word for EPA management, and they made the risk assessors tone that down to supplemental. But however it's described, the definition was worthless. It was worthless. So we had now a chemical that was on the market, used on millions of acres, that had failed to meet the requirements for registration. Well, that didn't bother the EPA because very quickly and quietly, they granted clothianidin full registration. Now, that's a real slick move on the part of the EPA because when there is a condition, obviously that condition can be monitored and followed. But if they give it full registration, what the law says is they don't have to revisit that decision for 15 years. And that's exactly what they've hidden behind. Despite the rising evidence of the problems, they've pretty much thumbed their nose at the public and Congress and everybody else and said, well, you know, maybe we'll have an answer crisis in 2018. So the leaked memo was the Cutler-Dupree study. When I found out that the scientist had concluded that it was invalid, I asked if it was available, if it had been documented, and if I could get a copy. And realistically, it was a public document. I had every right to have it. But certainly the EPA preferred that it didn't get out into the public, and it became described as the infamous leaked memo. And it was largely the beginning of this issue on a more public basis. That was the start, the leaked memo.
Now, it's quite interesting that it's been cited over and over, and even recently it's been said that there is very little scientific research that has proven the impact of neonicotinoids, not only on the bees, but on other species. So I'd like to talk about that for a moment. Now, to begin with, Dr. Henk Tennekes, who's a Dutch toxicologist, first came out with his book, The Systemic Pesticides, A Disaster in the Making, which basically told what we can anticipate if the use of neonicotinoids, if they continue to use these chemicals in agriculture, and subsequently they're being used in, you know, by homeowners, so on and so forth. So, you know, it's not just an agricultural issue, but there's been a substantial amount of scientific research that has been peer-reviewed and published, and that's something that's very, very important. I just want to ask you, was the Cutler-Dupree study peer-reviewed as well?
I don't know if it was or not. I believe it was. I think it went through that part of the process. But the industry has really heavily influenced the peer review process as well. So peer review is not the absolute mark of legitimacy. Bayer has replicated that study, and they have said that it has cost them just under $1 million, has taken several years. They tried to get the initial results out before it had been peer-reviewed, before it had been published, to kind of do an end run around that process, and they were severely criticized by their fellow scientists, and we haven't heard anything from them at all now. This is a $1 million study that was supposedly going to answer all these questions, and if it did, I don't know why they haven't made it public.
Well, very interesting, especially when you take a look at the negative consequences as far as sales would be concerned, especially if they had to restrict the use of these chemicals. Now, speaking of
let me just say one more thing, June. There was a recent study released, and it was a study of the peer-reviewed evidence of the neonicotinoids and the bee problems, the pollinator problems. A group of international scientists looked at over 800 scientific studies, everything that they could find that was available, and the overwhelming number of those connected the neonicotinoids with the pollinator problems. There's no lack of science, and the reason we're hearing what we're hearing from industry is because if you have no obligation to the truth, you can say whatever you want. It's what, well, my dear departed father would have called them a bunch of lying sons of bitches. He was much more forward than I am, and basically these people are just lying through their teeth to try to cover what they're doing. There is no lack of evidence of the connection of the neonicotinoids to these bee losses. That doesn't mean that it's the only thing that's causing losses, but it's certainly the major player in this drama, without question.
Thanks, Tom. Now, in regards to the phrase colony collapse disorder, what is your feeling about that term?
Very interesting move on the part of the industry, because they very quickly seized upon that concept, that colony collapse, and certainly colony collapse does occur. It can be the final stages of the death of a colony, and there is colony collapse. But industry characterized it as a disorder, a malady, the great mystery, this bottomless pit into which we had to throw millions and millions of research dollars and spend years to try to answer the great mystery. And the collapse is only one of many manifestations of these neonicotinoids. And some of them we probably have yet to grasp. But the neonicotinoids can have both short and long-term effects. They can affect the viability of the queen, her fertility, the viability of the brood. They can poison the adults directly or over an extended period of time. The foragers can become disoriented, lose their memory, lose their ability to navigate, go out, fly out, not come back. It disrupts the communications within this intricate, delicately balanced superorganism, this social unit. So the neonicotinoids express themselves in many ways, and the collapse is only one of those symptoms. It is not a disorder. It is not a great mystery. It is not a malady. It's just one of the symptoms.
Thank you. Now, Tom, getting back to your own bees, where are your bees kept? Are they by any chance near any golf courses, conventional farms, any major areas where the pesticides are applied?
Well, that pretty much describes everywhere. I'm not near any golf courses, but I certainly could be. If I had bee yards in different locations, I could be near golf courses. Most of my bees are in farm country, and most of the commercially kept bees are in farm country, and farm country has been heavily affected by these systemic pesticides, used primarily as seed treatments, not exclusively, because there are additional uses, but seed treatments alone, the estimate is that they were used on crops that were planted to 242 million acres last year. 242 million acres were planted to commodity crops with treated seed. Now, these are compounds that accumulate over time with successive uses, are water-soluble, and migrate with the groundwater. The USGS, the Geological Survey, released a study not long ago where they had sampled Midwestern surface waters all the way from small streams to the Mississippi River over a two-year period, I believe. And they found the neonicotinoids in every sample that they took and in many of those samples at killing levels. So the environment is, the evidence that we have would tell us that the environment is heavily contaminated with these chemicals. And it's become very difficult for the bees and other pollinators and other insects and other invertebrates and soil microorganisms and earthworms to survive this onslaught.
Thank you.
One that people may be most familiar with is recently a petition was filed with the Fish and Wildlife Service to declare the monarch butterfly a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act because their population has declined by 90% since 1995.
It's amazing that all of these events are unfolding right in front of us and so many people have no idea what's going on. They're just completely clueless. And what I think is the most disturbing is that we have an agency that has been created specifically to be the watchdog for these different species, for the environment, for the people, and absolutely nothing has been done.
Well, it's worse than that, I think. It's not just that nothing has been done, but there's been a conscious effort not to reveal what's happening. And the example that I use is the way that the pesticide usage has been reported. And we've discussed this more than once, and I'm sure many of the listeners, if they know me, have heard me say this. But what they've done is they've tried to cover it up, and they've told us publicly, told the people, that the amount of pesticides being used has decreased since the introduction of genetically modified crops. On its face, that's simply not true, but what they're doing is they're reporting these in pounds. They would claim that 10 years ago we were applying a billion pounds and now we're applying 200 million pounds less. But I use the analogy of rocks and nuclear warheads. They're both weapons, but you wouldn't compare them by weighing them. And these new pesticides, the neonicotinoids, are among the most toxic ever produced. They're 5,000 to 10,000 times as toxic as DDT. And we've used DDT as the comparison. The highest level of usage for DDT was 1959, 80 million pounds. The most recent figure we have for the neonicotinoids is 2013, 3.5 million pounds. Now, if you follow the pound philosophy, that looks like a real improvement. 80 million pounds of DDT in 1959, 3.5 million pounds of neonicotinoids in 2013. What a dramatic improvement that is, until you factor in the toxicity. Those 3.5 million pounds have the toxic equivalent of between 20 and 30 billion pounds of DDT. It's almost beyond comprehension. These people have to know what they're doing. They have to know that they're misreporting it and misleading everyone. Else, why would they do it?
Market share. Profit.
This is huge. They're applying the equivalent of 20 to 30 billion pounds of DDT every year. And we're supposed to believe that it's been an improvement. It's a wonder that there's anything alive at the lower end of the food chain.
Now, Tom, I have an interesting question for you because this is something that I hear all the time from new beekeepers, especially people that have been keeping bees for maybe, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years even. Now, for the most part, they're hobbyist beekeepers. There's a significant difference between a commercial beekeeper, a commercial migratory beekeeper, like someone like Jeff Anderson who travels all over the country with his bees, and a hobbyist beekeeper. So this is a little bit of a number of questions combined into one, but number one, can you explain the difference between, I guess, responsibilities between a commercial beekeeper as opposed to a hobbyist beekeeper, and how is it that the hobbyist beekeepers basically are not experiencing much of any problems with their bees? In fact, some of them have been reporting that they've been doing quite well as far as honey production.
Well, I'm not sure that they're not experiencing problems with their bees. We have had, like many other parts of the country, a large increase in the number of hobbyist beekeepers here in our area. And I've been a part of that for the last 13 years. I've taught a portion of an 8-week beginning beekeeping class, and the influx of new beekeepers has been important because they've helped to keep the population of bees up. Were it not for the beekeepers, we would see the same sort of statistics for the honeybee that we're seeing for the monarch butterfly. It's the beekeepers who make the difference. The newcomers, though, are at a disadvantage because they don't really have a context in which to understand what it is they're seeing. They don't really know what a healthy colony of bees or a healthy community of bees is because there hasn't been one in their tenure in the bee world. There's been such a decline within the last few years that most of the new beekeepers are seeing bees that are struggling. I did what was called double queening. I would establish a second queen in a colony through the middle of the summer, and it produced a very productive colony of bees. And they might produce 240 pounds of honey, a single colony. Now, for the hobbyists, they're not doing this for the business, and if they get a gallon or two of honey, they think that it's been a successful year. Well, it hasn't. And the bees are struggling, and it's difficult for the hobbyists to recognize that because they don't have anything to compare it to.
Now, in regards to your own honey production, could you share with our listeners what it was like when you first started to what you're experiencing now?
I was a one-man operation, and I'm sure my larger commercial friends would chuckle at my production because they produce far more than I do. But as a community beekeeper, as a one-man operation, it was about all that I could handle. And in a typical summer, I might produce between 3 and 4 tons of really high-quality table honey. The year of my highest production was about 15,000 pounds. You have to understand that for a small beekeeper, this is a very labor-intensive sort of a business, and I estimated that from the time I pulled the honey at the end of the summer to the time when it finally went out the door and I turned it over to a customer, I had personally lifted every pound of that honey 12 times. Very labor intensive. So that's declined. Those production figures have declined dramatically in the last few years, and I had virtually no honey crop this year. And not only did those bees not produce a surplus, but many of them didn't even make their winter stores. I'll have to feed those bees heavily in the fall if there's any hope at all of bringing them through the winter, and I may not. They still may not make it. So I could be looking at the end, and I'm afraid that the dilemma that we face is it may make no difference how well we discharge our responsibilities as beekeepers because we're sending potentially healthy bees out into an environment that's so hostile to life that they cannot survive. This has been an enormous poisoning of the earth.
Now, Tom,
and I'm not overstating that.
No, you're most certainly not. Now, you've known so many beekeepers that have also lost their operations. Jim Doan, he's from New York. He lost his operation last year. There's been a number of big commercial beekeepers that have gone under, and so many that are not necessarily going to make the headlines, much less their information circulated throughout social media and on, you know, within the beekeeping community. But what are some of the other beekeepers experiencing that you know that do have commercial operations? How critical is it for them?
It's very difficult because their losses through the course of a season are huge. They may lose 80% of their bees in the course of a season, in some cases more. And the only reason that they're able to maintain their numbers is because throughout the season they're taking their stronger colonies and they're splitting them and making two or three from one. And of those two or three, one or two of them are going to die, and they'll take that other one and split it. And so they're trying to replace their numbers throughout the season, and the net result of that is the bees that they end the season with are not the bees they started with. The losses are masked to that degree. You hear reports that the winter losses have been 30%, but the real losses have been much closer to 80, 90, even 100%. It can't continue. They're not going to be able to continue. And while I'm saddened by the loss of my business, I'm looking at friends who are second and third generation whose lives are dependent upon this business, and they may not make it. They're all struggling.
Now, in regards to the next steps, I mean, what do they do once their beekeeping operation ceases to exist? I mean, what are you going to do?
Well, you know, beekeepers are like farmers or many other people with outdoor occupations. Many of them have lots of skills that they've developed over the years that are marketable. You know, many of them are good welders, and they've had to be good welders because they needed to know that to do their business. So they have other skills, but they really want to continue doing what they've done and what their families have done for, in some cases, over 100 years. And we're losing them. We're losing them. This is an American tragedy.
What are you going to do if you can't keep your bees going, if you can't keep them alive for next year?
Don't know. I mean, I have other interests in life, but it will be a death in the family.
It's indeed very tragic, and unfortunately, this is happening to so many commercial beekeepers, and unfortunately, not everybody has the advantage of utilizing their skills to get a job. Some of the feedback that I've been getting is, you know, we don't know where to go. We don't know where to get a job, what to do, so on and so forth, because let's face it, the economy is not great right now. There are a lot of people competing for even some of the most basic jobs, and especially as you get older, when you have a very specific set of skills, it becomes that much more difficult to find employment, especially if you're working for somebody else for the first time in a very long time, or perhaps for the first time, especially if you've been working for a family of beekeepers, you know.
I don't know what they'll do. I don't know.
Well, Tom, I just want to say thank you for coming on the show tonight. We're actually out of time. I know that this was not an easy discussion for you to have, especially since this has been something that's part of your life. I mean, you eat, breathe, and sleep it. And to see something that has been such a huge part of your life just fall apart, and there's just nothing that you can really do about it, it's awful.
I'm going to try to bring as many of the colonies through the winter as I can, and hope to put it back together to some degree in the spring, and hope for one more year. But it doesn't look good. As I said, it may not make any difference how hard I work. I may just not be able to keep them alive.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. And once again, I sincerely wish you all the best with your operation, and I hope you have better news.
I do, too. I hope I am wrong, but I don't believe I am. But I hope to have good news, too.
Well, we will definitely have to have you come back to talk about any hope.
I'm ready. Anytime.
Yeah. it's just really hard, especially since, you know, you are a dear friend, and just to listen to you go through this, it's just awful. But
We're not done yet.
Well, we're going to keep fighting. But,
yep.
Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Steuer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a pleasant evening.